And here is today's headline.
Surrender. There were no reserves.
Peeking at my x-rays.
It's the end of July, 1943. Over the radio, Bing Crosby is crooning, Bob Hope is joking, and news of the war in Europe and in Japan keeps sizzling and crackling across the dial. But in Southern California, something else is creeping through the air, something foul and inexplicable. Grown men are crying and mopping their eyes. Women's throats are sore and their eyes an unflattering shade of red.
It was a scorching hot day, and sort of out of nowhere, a cloud bank enveloped downtown Los Angeles. It came at such a pace that it caught everybody off guard.
This is Chip Jacobs. He's someone I know as a big name in Southern California journalism and books. A few years back, he co-wrote a book called Smogtown, The Lung-Burning History of Pollution in Los Angeles.
Cops directing traffic all of a sudden didn't know what direction the streetlight was in. You know, think about a window washer, you know, three or four stories up. Now they can't see the person working the ropes. Mother supposedly grabbed children's hands, this sounds like my mom, and thrust them into a department store to get out of it.
This wasn't just a heat wave. Angelenos knew from heat waves. And this wasn't some random summer fog nor some odd blast of weird weather. This was something else, something brownish, blackish, grayish, and sickening.
I started watering, your nose started running. You know, it was a kind of a respiratory assault on you. And panic spread.
Rumor ran amok. The year before, in February 1942, an enemy Japanese submarine had shelled an oil field near Santa Barbara. And the very next night, LA was rattled by sirens and the noise of anti-aircraft fire in the blackout. Now, that was a false alarm and a citywide case of nerves. But maybe this time, with whatever was in the air, it wasn't.
And so people thought, okay, this is, they've done something else, they're lobbing some chemical shell. I think that passed quickly, but there was really panic in the air.
So it wasn't the Japanese, but it was something of our own making, from an enemy that LA would be fighting long after World War II was over. Smog.
Because smog had never hit with the intensity it did that day.
July 1943 changed LA's story full stop. Even though we were just starting to call it smog, that wasn't a good word for this crud. Smog was a word born in the 20th century, a portmanteau of smoke and fog, describing the sooty, deadly air of the London of Sherlock Holmes. What afflicted LA wasn't entirely smoke or fog, but something new, like LA itself. The air tasted like a chemistry set, and it looked like something that hadn't quite flushed down your toilet. Yet, crazy as it sounds, this is a success story. Over 7 or 8 decades, we pretty much beat smog, at least to a standstill. Crazier still, that we're now having to fight the old battles again with a White House that wants to flip back the calendar on LA's clean air crusade. So we'd better reacquaint ourselves with how we did it the first time, how hard it was, because we may have to bring out the battle plans again.
They're drinking the water.
I'm Pat Morrison, and you've crossed the border into Smoglandia.
During one of the most severe windstorms Southern California experienced in more than a decade, the Palisades and Eaton fires ignited, leaving heartbreaking losses in our communities. Now, as we build back, we're building stronger, cleaner, and more resilient. In communities most vulnerable to dangerous weather conditions and wildfires, Southern California Edison is placing power lines underground, hardening the electric system by installing wires with protective coating, and adding advanced technology to help keep communities safe. So when Southern California faces the next storm, the next most severe event, we'll be ready. Learn more at SCE.com/disaster recovery. And if you were impacted by the Eaton Fire, you may qualify for direct compensation through Southern California Edison's Wildfire Recovery Compensation Program. File your claim directly with no legal fees, no litigation, and receive payment in months, not years. To file and learn more, visit SCE.com/direct claims.
I'm Jesse Alejandro Cottrell.
And I'm Emily Dreyfus. And this is Pacific Standard Time.
We have stories from all over the state of California, all the big battles that are happening here.
Prop 50.
Housing affordability.
Tech.
And immigration.
And we're really excited to bring you the stories about how California is dealing with what it means to be alive in 2025.
Subscribe to Pacific Standard Time, a new weekly show from the San Francisco Standard.
We'll have new episodes every Wednesday starting November 19th, wherever you get your podcasts.
You know the setup, once upon a time, yada yada, there was a far-off land, and at the newborn's cradle, three magical spirits came with gifts. In our version, beautiful beaches, magnificent mountains, and spotless sunshine. Then the last of these spirits bustled in, uninvited, unwelcome, and bestowed one last gift. Something stinky, greasy, ugly, a curse. In the fairy tale I'm about to tell, the baby in question is the beautiful, magical place called Los Angeles. And its curse? Smog. In Southern California, the smog changed the look of movies. Smog shredded women's nylon stockings right off their legs. It chewed through rubber tires and windshield wipers. It could kill off a crop of spinach in a matter of hours. It messed with aviation. Once it skewed the odds of a beauty pageant at the Glendale Airport because the planes flying in contestants from around Southern California couldn't land in the smog. Smog is why even today there's that rubber condom around the gas nozzle when you put gas in your tank. Also why you pay more for that gas. And it's why, as Dennis Farina's character Bones Barboni says in the movie Get Shorty, the f***ing smog is the f***ing reason you have such beautiful f***ing sunsets. Smog has been the blight on all that's beautiful in L.A., but what many people don't know is that it hasn't just been here for a long time. It's been here for a really, really long time.
So you've been to the Tar Pits Park many times.
Oh my gosh. The smell is still in my nostrils. Excuse me, the fragrance is still in my nostrils.
I know, it's hard to sort of...
I'm at the La Brea Tar Pits in Los Angeles, fabled for the fossils of Ice Age giant fauna like mammoths and wolves and massive sloths.
It's an amazing natural substance.
My guide is Reagan Dunn, a paleobotanist who's showing me the gardens surrounding these ancient and famously stinky pits.
So you think of the Ice Age. Here in Southern California, we didn't have ice, but we did have glaciers up in the Sierra Nevada.
So more the slush age for us than the Ice Age.
We wouldn't have recognized the Ice Age, Los Angeles. It had huge shade trees and little streams and waterways crisscrossing everywhere. That's what's growing in the Tar Pits Pleistocene Garden. But keep walking, and you see the Coastal Garden, a peek into the landscape of 13,000 years ago, which is more like what L.A. looks like today. Dense with scrubby growth, stuff that burned back then the way it does today. Sometimes deliberately.
Well, the hypothesis that we have put out there is that these fires were ignited by early humans that came to this area.
There's evidence for, shall we say, Renaissance-era smog. The L.A. basin is built like a pot, and warm air sometimes puts a lid on it and keeps everything contained, even smoke. It's called the inversion layer. In October 1542, when sailors aboard a Spanish ship first laid eyes on the L.A. terrain, they saw this phenomenon, as Captain Juan Rodriguez Cabrillo's ship log made note.
They approached land set in the large bay, which they called Bay of the Smokes, Los Humos, because of the large amount of smoke hovering over it.
And there's some evidence right under our feet in the ground. The soil tells its own story, and it seems the Tongva and other indigenous people in Southern California did controlled burns. What made early Angelenos such fans of fire? Was it to keep the four-legged carnivores at bay?
We don't know if this activity was part of making the environment more habitable for humans.
In what way? You mean in keeping away the dire wolves and the saber-toothed tigers?
That's right. Or opening up the landscape so humans can have a better view of what's hiding behind the trees or in the bushes.
Fire is a tool, and early people would have used it to clear the way for plants they used, like acorns for food, willows for huts, and grasses for baskets. Whatever the purpose, human-set fires were changing California even thousands of years ago and generating a lot of smoke.
There's some documentation out there that suggests that, you know, as much of the quarter of the state was burned each year.
Mostly by human hands?
Yes.
Wow. So we don't have a 20th century license on smog then?
We don't, but it's, you know, it's a part of the human adaptation to living in this landscape.
Dunn and the team at the Natural History Museum learned this through a critical discovery in the prehistoric record. They used paleoenvironmental records to look at what the climate back then was like. They also tracked the history of fire by looking at charcoal preserved at the bottoms of lakes. And they found evidence of hot, dry weather, and they found evidence of large fires. But what the records couldn't show was what caused those fires. They had to deduce that themselves.
We know that the earliest evidence of human presence in California is 13,000 years ago, because there are specimens of a human being from Santa Rosa Island that date to that time period. What really was striking to me, which made me nearly fall out of my chair, was seeing this amazing record of charcoal from Lake Elsinore that was work done by Lisa Martinez, a master student at the time at UCLA. She had been working, you know, separately, and when we discovered that this record existed, I pulled it up on Google Scholar and saw the record of charcoal over the last 33,000 years. And you can see there is very, 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 very little fire up until 13,200 years ago. And when I saw that, my chin dropped and I just said, yep, it's humans.
But Regan Dunn told me something else. We can say that early Angelenos were responsible for what we now recognize as altering the environment, like filling the basin with smoke, but we can't call it blame. Humans always manipulate their environment to survive and don't always recognize what it might be damaging in the long run. Now, push that rule forward by, 13,000 years to today, Angelenos creating their own destruction with smog and not even knowing it, until they did. That's after the break.
Who's abducting 100,000 children in China each year? And how was a cult where pedophilia, murder, and torture were commonplace allowed to operate in Chile for nearly four decades? At True Crime Reports, a new video podcast from Al Jazeera, we'll investigate these stories from the Global South and beyond. True crimes that often haven't reached the headlines in the West. I'm Hala Mohideen. In each episode, we'll take you to a different country. You'll hear from experts and first-hand accounts from those right at the heart of these stories. True Crime Reports. Find us under Al Jazeera's YouTube channel podcast tab and wherever you get your podcasts.
Call it what you will, ever since we have built cities, we've made smog. The ancient Romans burned so much wood and other fuel for cooking, for industry, for the Vestal Virgin's eternal flame, so much fuel that modern scientists concluded it would have lowered the climate of Europe by 0.3 degrees Fahrenheit. Or, as the Romans would say, 0.III degrees. A dozen centuries later, the English were choking on it, too. So much so that a 13th century Dowager Queen of England had to move out of her home, well, castle, because of the smoke from burning something called sea coal, a kind of driftwood coal. Years later, in 1307, her son, King Edward I drafted England's first recorded pollution proclamation. If you burned or even sold that filthy sea coal with its, quote, hellish and dismal cloud, you will be tortured or hanged. At least one man chanced it anyway and was executed. There are a lot of ingredients in the recipe for smog, and each city's isn't the same. Looking at you, Houston, and Bakersfield. Pollution has changed just about everything around us, even the light.
Oh, we're going to come back here?
We're going to just go in the next room. Okay. You can't take anything with you.
The L.A. before smog was something to behold, and the artist Helen Paskian is one of the people who remembers it.
Okay, now this is I'm not going to say anything about it. We're just going to sit down.
Paskian grew up in Altadena. It's a foothill neighborhood above Pasadena at the feet of the San Gabriel Mountains, and it suffered catastrophically in the fires of January 2025. And for the most part, until the early 1940s, it was all blue skies that the real estate agents in the Chamber of Commerce sold and sang about, those decades when the air was literally fragrant with orange blossoms from the citrus groves and the backyard trees.
You know, California was very rural, and all the little towns were connected by citrus and everything, eucalyptus trees in between, as windbreaks.
The novelist and journalist Theodore Dreiser had this to say about the air of L.A. in 1921.
The freshness of the air, the sea wind. We drive onto the edge of Beach Drive, then back and park the car. Go to one of the best places and have sundaes, lemonades, etc. At 10:30, we start back. Delightful air.
A dozen years later, he moved here and stayed. Back then, even from the hills 20 miles inland, you really could see Catalina and the Pacific, and streets with names like Sea View and Ocean View weren't just real estate come-ons. You could see the mountains as clearly as if they were just at the end of your street, and the light, that crystalline light, was clear and pure and brilliant.
It's a certain kind of cool light. You know how we call it the Golden State? Wrong. The golden light is in the south of France and in Spain, around the Riviera. That's truly the golden light. But California's light is cool, and if you talk to most artists, they agree with that.
Paskian has been a pioneer in California's light and space art movement since the 1960s. She's famous for her installations that challenge the way we interact with light. Over the decades, she has watched the light of Los Angeles change, along with the rest of the world.
When Pearl Harbor happened, everything happened very quickly, because in the course of 3 or 4 years during the war, Southern California changed from a rural place with lots of agriculture to urban.
The first part of the 20th century had filled Los Angeles with middle-class Midwesterners, enticed by the delights of the movies, the climate, and of course, the air. When World War II came, it brought new people, the defense industries, and their workers. Here's Chip Jacobs again.
There was a lot of reasons that people were moving here by the hundreds of thousands, and L.A. was creating a different type of culture than the East Coast and the Midwest. It was creating a much more horizontal urban sprawl. Every man has his castle, right?
From Paskian's home in Altadena, she could see the air beginning to take on a different quality.
We would see a line of this yellowish, pinkish haze, which was new. We'd never seen that before.
Some of the taller buildings downtown, including City Hall, 27 stories, were also starting to disappear from view.
They were always crystal clear, and we began to notice that they weren't so clear anymore. So something was obstructing them.
Paskian was witnessing the big bang of Los Angeles smog. Through grade school and then into high school, Paskian saw the look of her beautiful hometown change with those afternoon visits from this new kind of air, strange and thick and stinky.
I think there was a smell to it. I guess it just smelled dead. We all got bikes one year for Christmas, and because we had to ride our bikes to school. So we rode our bikes down, we pedaled them back up the hill. And I remember in the afternoons, pedaling my bike up this steep hill, I would be panting a little bit. And what I was taking into my lungs didn't taste so good. But later on, when the smog got really bad, before I left for college, you take a deep breath like that, and you could feel the pain right here.
Helen Pashkian and everyone she knew did the only thing they could. They adapted.
In the morning in the summer when it was hot, like in July, we'd go out and pick all the fruit early, you know, white nectarines and so forth, the Babcock peaches, and we'd go out because the smog was going to come. I mean, you guided your life and you changed your life to fit the patterns of the smog.
As Pashkian says, many Angelenos had started to accept smog as a fact of life. The English novelist Evelyn Waugh found plenty to write about in Los Angeles, like his novel The Loved One, a satire about our over-the-top cemetery industry. This is what he wrote to a friend in February 1947, right after getting off the train in Pasadena.
Empty building lots everywhere and vast distances. Since the war, they have succeeded in spoiling even the climate by inducing an artificial and noxious fog.
For days at a stretch, usually in the late summer or September and October, you couldn't take a deep breath or get a good look around you. Do something, people told the men in charge. Do something. The country was at war with enemies you could see. Enemy soldiers, tanks, bombers. But where could L.A. put up a fight against smog?
They viewed it not as an environmental problem because nobody knew what an environmental problem was. They viewed it as an industrial engineering problem. And that it must be some bad factory or warehouse or a gas leak.
To understand what happened next, you have to recognize the marriage of convenience between L.A. and the oil business. You probably know it already. You've seen the oil pump checks laboring away in nutty places, like on the La Cienega Boulevard shortcut through Baldwin Hills to the airport. That all got started on November 4th, 1892, when yet another hopeful newcomer to L.A., a fellow named Edward Doheny, took a eucalyptus log and sharpened it like a number two pencil and went chonking away at a patch of dirt in Echo Park and struck oil. Well, you couldn't stop the drilling after that. Between downtown and Venice Beach, thousands of homeowners tore out the orange trees and put oil derricks right in their backyards. Signal Hill, near Long Beach, was pincushioned with so many oil rigs that one writer said the place looked like an aroused porcupine. But the oil biz, with its lakes and streams of spilled oil, was also making Angeleno sick, even just a few years after Doheny struck it rich. And now, with the war on, with the big smokestacks on those big oil refineries, we're sending out big black plumes of gunk. And that had to be making the smog, right?
Texaco, Unocal, Arco, sort of the heart of L.A. oil, they felt scapegoated for air pollution before we'd even done any chemical analysis. Because the natural public inclination, well, it must be the black smoke we see coming out of a refiner, or it must be out of a factory. That created a kind of a negative feedback loop over the years of people and businesses and CEOs saying, you're blaming us before we even know the science.
It looked like an obvious place to start. Follow the ugly fumes and find the smog. Elementary, my dear City Hall.
Maybe to mollify the public, they targeted a gas company butadiene plant. Butadiene, this plant was on Aliso Street in downtown L.A., and it was helping produce artificial rubber.
The factory was there to produce butadiene for the war. Some government official heard the complaints and made the call.
So they shut this plant down, and guess what? The smog, it eventually returned. And when that smog returned and that plant was shut down, well, by process of elimination, we know it wasn't that butadiene plant. And I think that's what really sent shockwaves through people's systems.
The smog control people versus the oil people would be a thing for years to come. But for the moment, there was a war on. And if some smog was the price of victory, well, so be it. But when the war ended and the smog didn't, L.A. began to wipe its weepy red eyes and demand some answers, damn it. That brown, greasy cloud was taking something with it, something of the paradise spirit. The economy, the outdoors, our culture, and our pride in the place. Smog didn't just change our character. It became a character in our lives. And a miserable one, too. Then some people, and soon the right people, began to ask the right questions.
And then people at Caltech, we knew lots of people at Caltech, and then they started looking at the changing atmosphere.
Okay, yeah, people at Caltech are looking into the mystery of the universe. Einstein's looking into whether time is flexible. And oh, by the way, what the hell is causing the smog in Los Angeles?
Of such a problem, so serious as air pollution, wishful thinking has no place, and only an objective and realistic approach can help us in finding the right course to take.
The mystery of the sickening fog was about to get its own Sherlock Holmes. He was brilliant, good-looking, Dutch, and had a strange fascination for the scent of pineapples. Smoglandia is hosted by me, Pat Morrison. Our senior producers are Mary Knopf and Jonathan Shiflett of Studiophonic. Our editors are Hugo Martin, Shelby Grad, and Steve Clow. Our director of library services is Carrie Schneider. Additional sound design and engineering by Hannes Brown. Special thanks to our editor, Hugo Martin, for reading Cabrillo's ship log, and LA Times reporter Richard Winton for voicing Evelyn Waugh. Our podcast marketing manager is Bryn Jura, and our product marketing director is Becca Dorman. Special thanks to LA Times studio president Anna Mogzanian, president and chief operating officer of the Los Angeles Times, Chris Argentieri, and executive editor of the Los Angeles Times, Terry Tang. Smoglandia is executive produced by Darius Derrickshawn.
I'm journalist Henry Bonsu. I'm working with Foreign Policy to bring you The Threshold, a new podcast about the fight to end infectious disease. How close are we? Where can the financing come from? And what's at stake if we fall short? The Threshold is a 7-part series made possible in part through funding from the Gates Foundation, available on all the major platforms.